This was a big chat as we delve into the wet tropics rainforest of northern Queensland. Today, I'm chatting with a very important mentor of mine, Terry Carmichael, and he will be chatting to us about the oldest continuously surviving tropical rainforest on Earth, which is found right here in northern Queensland, Cairns. He's also going to tell us what actually makes our rainforest a World Heritage Area and where did we get our plants and animals from. As this was a big chat, we have split it into two. So today's episode is part one. I hope you enjoy. Have you ever wondered how a kangaroo can live in a tree? What about crocodiles and how they can stay underwater for hours at a time and not be seen? Maybe what keeps you up at night is your thoughts of how box jellyfish can be the most venomous animal in the whole world towards humans. Or is it your curiosity of what really goes on inside that caterpillar cocoon for a magnificent, stunning butterfly to emerge? Well, don't worry, as I have all your questions answered and much, much more with our following Wild Chats. I am going to bring you the most amazing guests. Hey everyone, my name is Jodie Creek and I'm a wildlife educator and huge advocate for Australian animals. And of course their habitats and ecosystems as well. But what I'm truly passionate about is bringing you information that you need to connect with the natural world. So someone once said to me that I may not be able to change the world, but I can change the world around me. So let's hope that we can inspire you to make change at home, and therefore together we do actually change the world. So get that cup of tea ready and enjoy the following Wild Chats. I finally tracked you down, Terry Carmichael. How are you going?
Yes, very good, Jodie. Thank you.
I'm pretty excited to have this chat about our stunning and beautiful wet tropics. And just so everyone knows a little bit about yourself, can you tell me where'd you come from and where are you now? And then let's chat about the magical place of North Queensland.
Absolutely. Look, I grew up in a beautiful part of the world in northern New South Wales called Coffs Harbour. Beautiful big Pacific Ocean swells, beautiful, now World Heritage Rainforest. Back there around Dorrigo in New England, and just grew up with oceans and mountains with rainforest. That inevitably was in my DNA, and that led me very slowly but surely to Brisbane, where again we have those same rainforests, the Gondwanan Rainforest of Australia, which is a series of World Heritage Areas from southeast Queensland all the way to Newcastle virtually. And tragically and horribly, some of that rainforest did get burnt over the last fire season. But that's another story. And then off to the Blue Mountains, which is another World Heritage Area. Spent 6 years down in Sydney in the lower Blue Mountains. Giant World Heritage Area, that one. That's in Woolloomooloo National Park to the north of the Blue Mountains. And significant landscapes for sure. And then that took me to Port Douglas, to paradise. And 27 years ago, landing in Port Douglas, this is my home. I found my spiritual place and soul place, and I'm now living in a little tiny area called Gelatin, just behind Port Douglas, tableland area, if you like. Yeah, love living here, love living in the tropics, but it's been rainforest. And honestly, what it was I think as a 3 or 4 or 5 year old driving up to Dorrigo, west of Coffs Harbour, there was just this sign with all these waterfalls and lookout names on this sign. It was pointed into the jungle, rainforest, of course, it is not jungle. But as a kid, it's jungle.
Yeah.
And I wanted to know what was down that track. And all those years later, here I am. And I love the dry parts of Australia. You know, I spend a lot of time in tropical savanna. I spend a lot of time in Tasmania, another stunning location. But, oh, it's this tropical rainforest that is, for me, it's the biodiversity, very high levels of biodiversity, never boring. Always seeing new things.
Absolutely.
Keep you going. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I actually met you. You were the curator of, back in the days, it was called the Wildlife Habitat.
Yeah, that's right.
Or Rainforest Habitat, wasn't it?
Rainforest Habitat.
Rainforest Habitat.
Yeah, in Port Douglas. It was a new concept back in the day. It was these mixed species exhibits where, visit to the zoo, you'd get inside the enclosure and all the animals would be around you. And they'd be all living together. And I think that was a great way. People visiting Port Douglas or Cairns to come immerse themselves in a tropical rainforest setting with all those animals. Because as we're going to talk about today, it's not easy to see animals.
No.
I'm a tourist from time to time. And I know by the time I've had a sleep in and a nice breakfast on holidays and I get out and about, it's usually midday when we get to these natural areas. And there's one thing about Australia is there's not much moving around midday in Australia. it's either dawn or dusk or nighttime. The vast majority of Australian mammals are, of course, as you well know, nocturnal.
Yeah,
that was a great experience. It was fun working with you and sharing your passion about telling people about the natural world. And
Terry, I wouldn't be where I am now without you. I have to say that.
Oh, you're so sweet, Jane.
Serious.
No, kindred souls, absolutely. No doubt about that. And, of course, my great influence, and he is a living international icon, is Sir David Attenborough. I'm at high school watching Life on Earth and just being mesmerised by what he's showing us. And as he's in his latest series, A Witness Statement, you know, he's telling us about the world he grew up in. And I've got sad news for everyone listening, is it's the same experience for me. After 40 years, I'm noticing the difference. There is a huge difference out there with the natural environment and the animals that live in it. So, yeah, it's important that we get this message out there to people that, and this is part of our storytelling today, that these living things give us our life support system. We all need clean water, clean soil and clean air to breathe. And it's the living components of the landscape outside these walls that give us those things to live. We don't need to go to Mars and take our life support system with us. We've got one here. Let's look after this one. We need to breathe clean air, we need to drink clean water, and we need clean soil for our food to grow in.
Yeah.
And that's my simple message for the day. It's complex.
It's pretty scary to think that within 60 years, you know, the quality of our soil is dead. That's still in my lifetime. I'll be 100, but it'll be my children's. And I just can't imagine it, Terry.
I think the nice thing is I think I can see a big change coming. I really can. I think we're waking up to ourselves slowly but surely.
Yep.
We want to offer our children something for the future, and that's a really important thing. And, I think we can do it. We're pretty clever animals. Look where we've come in a very short period of time. And that's why I also like history. I think, you know, I've always been a bit of a history buff, you know, just studying civilizations that have come and gone and why they're gone. And, you know, pretty simple. It's a simple message is look after our life support system.
Yep, for sure. So now you work for Wet Tropics Management Authority.
Yeah, absolutely. I set out to do this when I first went to the first protected area management course after high school, and that was being delivered in Queensland at Gatton, which was an agricultural college in its day. It's now It's now a branch of Queensland University. But, yeah, it was a whole bunch of us who wanted to be park rangers. And inevitably, I got kind of sidetracked. I got into looking after animals in the zoo industry and telling people about animals and getting people and animals together and seeing, this is another phenomenon, the expressions on young people's faces when they get up close and touch a koala or a crocodile or a python or a kangaroo. There's something we have when we're young. This is an ability to appreciate biodiversity for its real value. And then, I don't know, we get sidetracked. We get a job, we get married, we get a mortgage, and you still appreciate it, but it's not that dominating factor in our lives anymore. But look at the face of a child when they're 4 or 5 and you take them to meet an amazing animal. They're hypnotised by it. So I believe it's in us. I think life gets in the way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. That's why I love working with children.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. I never got sick of it. I just realised I needed to go back to my roots. So that's when I left the zoo industry, probably 10 years ago now, and got into protected area management work for the Wet Tropics Management Authority, where I have the joy of telling people about why the Wet Tropics is special. We know why the Great Barrier Reef is special. It is, you know, one of the natural wonders of the world. There's no doubt about it. And it's suffering. And that's it's not been on the front page of the newspaper recently for the wrong reasons, which is good. So let's hope this is a non-bleaching year for the Great Barrier Reef.
Yeah.
But beside the Great Barrier Reef, 450 kilometres down the side of the Great Barrier Reef is a thing called the Wet Tropic World Heritage Area, which I want to argue today is just as significant as the Great Barrier Reef. And it tells us as well, as Australians or visitors from overseas, about an amazing story, one of the greatest untold stories going around. And I'll just phrase it easily by saying, how does one of the world's oldest tropical rainforests occur on the world's driest inhabited continent? How did that happen? That's a weird one. And that's what the Wet Tropics is. It's recognised globally as the second most irreplaceable natural world heritage area in the world. And there's a reason for that. So I hope we can talk about that today and kind of,
Absolutely.
The surface of that, why is it important? What does it tell us about Australia? Yeah, and I think people will be surprised with some of the little messages there that have come out about why it's so special.
Oh, for sure. Well, I think you should take it away. But one thing I do want to say is I totally understand and can relate with you about rainforest. I love the dry and I love the feeling of going to the dry parts of Australia, the feel of it, the breeze and everything. But there's something about the tropical rainforest that is just, as soon as I'm in it, my soul, like, oh, I can't, you know exactly.
Yes, I do know exactly what you mean. But recently, in the last couple of months, I spent a good 4 days and four nights out in it, and it just recharged my batteries. Yep. I live in a most beautiful location, and I live very close to rainforest here, but to live in it and adventure through it, hear the birds and the frogs crawling at dusk and dawn and getting into their cycle and understanding that, it's very impressive.
Absolutely.
You know, recharged my batteries for sure.
I am all with you with that one. So tell us, Terry, why is the wet tropics so special? Like, what? Tell us all about it. Whatever you've got.
Well,
we don't have 20 days, but we've got...
We're going to start why we found out about it first. Why did it become a World Heritage Area? Because it's a really important point, and it's because people started to care. And I think most of the listeners would be going, well, yeah, I remember the Daintree blockade in the 80s when there was going to be a road pushed through between Cape Tribulation and Aitken, or Woodja, which is an Indigenous community just north of Cape Tribulation. And people chained themselves to trees. They buried themselves in the ground in front of the bulldozer, and the police had to come and remove them so this road could be pushed through. And, yes, it's a very famous demonstration of care for tropical rainforests. But it's not the first. The first time people cared about our tropical rainforest happened just south of Cairns, down at a place called Bingle Bay or Mission Beach, and I think people are very familiar with that part of the world. It's another beautiful reef meets rainforest location. And it was a gentleman who studied art in Melbourne, went to university in Melbourne, Algonquin, and John was married to Alison, and they bought Bagara Island way back in the 40s. And that was a lost paradise in the day. And John sold bits of Bagara Island over time and moved to the mainland, moved to Bingle Bay and built a home he called Ninny Rise. John was an artist and he knew poets and he knew authors, and there was a community of conservation-minded people there in the mid-60s who inevitably got a lot of support from the federal government, because John went to school with a guy called Harold Holt, and he was a prime minister who tragically and sadly died in office. He went for a swim one morning and never came back. But Harold was initially the treasurer and then the prime minister. And John rang up Harold one day and said, Harold, I've got this reef that they want to mine for lime to put on their sugarcane crops, and I've got this rainforest that they're chopping down at a huge rate. What can I do? So I think Harold Holt was the prime minister of the day, and he just got CSIRO involved. And two scientists came up, a Len Webb and a Jeff Tracy, and they started to look at this rainforest. And we always thought, oh, look, it's just any old rainforest. It's just rainforest from Southeast Asia, the same as, you know, that rainforest in Asia. It's nothing special. It's not a special Australian rainforest. But they soon realised they were absolutely wrong. It was a special rainforest. In fact, it's got more different types of these ancient and relic flowering plant species than any other part of the world. They realised it was a long-lost rainforest that had been lost in time and space, and it was uniquely Australian, and it contained elements that occurred nowhere else in the world. Yes, it had influence by Southeast Asia, but inevitably it was its own special type of rainforest. So they're the first people that really cared about it back in the 60s. And that was kind of unique globally back then, because back then we were just getting over World War I and World War II, and we were trying to make the world a better place for humans and grow the population of countries and develop the world. Because in those days it was all about growing the population and developing the world, and not taking the time to smell the flowers and realise that biodiversity and nature was important and a really important part of the world we live in, and we were part of that. So I think it's great that we all know about the Daintree or blockade, and we all remember that from the 80s. And that was what started the nomination of the Wet Tropics World Heritage Area. There's no doubt about that. That was what really got people interested in nominating for World Heritage Values back then. Jody, is that noise going to be a problem?
I can't hear anything, Terry.
Thank you. So we cared about it in the 1960s and we cared about it in the 80s, and I think most of us remember it for the 80s, but inevitably we were caring about it way back in the 60s, which is nice to know that we were one of the first world countries in the world to care about our natural resources. So it's been in Australian DNA for a long time to care about this incredible country that we live in. It's one of a kind. And that's the other story for today. We know how weird Australia was. When Europeans came here, they saw black swans, not white swans. When they came here, they saw animals that looked like deer, but they hopped. And it was like this other world. I thought they went through the looking glass in Alice in Wonderland and came into another universe. Well, do you know what? Our tropical rainforest is just like that. It's like no other tropical rainforest on Earth for a whole bunch of reasons. And one of the most important reasons is if you go to Borneo, Sumatra, the Congo, or the Amazon, you'll notice that when you're there, it will rain fairly evenly in the 12 months of the year. There'll be rain falling in every month and it's fairly reliable. Here, I'm sure you could look out the window and see it's a crystal clear blue sky day. And so from in the wet tropics, our rainforest gets four dry months, typically from September, October, November, December. We can have very little rain that falls. So that's a really challenge for a great big rainforest tree. I'm very lucky in my job. I rub shoulders with scientists who work in this field, and they tell me that some of those trees in that forest need to pull up, and this is going to blow people's minds, 700 litres of water a day out of the ground, up their trunks, through their leaves, so that water is transpired out the leaves and goes into the atmosphere, and, of course, that comes out with oxygen as well. So there's part of our life support system. Wow, right there.
Yeah.
And at this time of year, it's a struggle for them. I'm sitting right under Mount Lewis, one of the most significant landscapes in the wet tropics, and it's been crystal clear blue skies up there for a couple of weeks now, and it's getting warm. Mm-hmm. It's starting to really get warm. So that's the unusual thing about our rainforest. It doesn't get those 12 months of rain. It gets maybe 8 months, 9 months of good rain, but there's always going to be 3 or 4 months where no rain falls. And that's a stress on plants, and they can't wait for those first seasonal storms to arrive. The other weird thing, which is just not typical, this is not, doesn't happen in the Borneo, Sumatra, the Congo, where the Amazon is, our lowlands are not full of really obvious animals. All of our really obvious and special animals, animals that are only found here, that animals that have been in the landscape for millions and millions of years, what we call ancient relic animals, occur in our mountaintops, not in our lowlands. So I think guests need some help when they go to the Dane Tree, and I hear it all the time. Had a lovely day in the Dane Tree, but I didn't see anything. I think it goes back to what we were saying before. We tend to get to our locations around midday, which is the wrong time to be in our forests anyway.
Yep.
But there's not a lot of big animals running around. You can see kasseris, which is great, but really, you know, they're not elephants, they're not tapirs, they're not rhinos, they're not a whole bunch of monkeys in the trees running around at midday. Our special animals are in the mountaintops, and they're there for a really good reason. They're there because natural climate change is a reality. We can look back through history, and scientists have incredible techniques to be able to glance back through time. And what we do know is that about 2.5 million years ago, global climate really did do some weird things. It went in and out of ice ages. So during an ice age, the polar caps grow ice. So Antarctica and the Arctic, those ice shelves grow and grow and grow with cool, dry climates. And they suck the water out of the ocean because ice floats on water. And sea levels drop and it's dry, so rainforests contract. And then about, and scientists argue, is it 35,000 years or is it every 100,000 years ice ages ebb and flow? And it depends on what you look at. And why does it happen? Because of the different elliptical orbits and the axial tilt of the Earth changes our climate naturally. Just there's a couple of cycles there that every couple of thousand years, perfect situation arises and it flips to a warm, wet climate. And in warm, wet climates, rainforests grow. So our wet tropics has gone through those massive changes in the last 2.5 million years. And animals and plants have got sick of moving out of the lowlands into the uplands where it's always reliably wet and cool. So mountains are rain creators. Great mountains are rain attractors. Just a physical thing. Mountaintops are always wetter than lowlands because they have cloud on them a lot of the time and they really are a rain magnet. They trap these trade winds that come off the Pacific Ocean or Coral Sea. And this goes all the way down to the east coast of Australia. It's a phenomena. There's a reason why the vast majority of the Australian population lives on the east coast, is we have reliable rainfall. And it's usually because of the Great Dividing Range. It's just off the coastline, and it catches that moist air and delivers that reliable rainfall throughout the year. And that's why the wet tropics is here. And then we get our monsoon, which is usually very reliable. A little bit of a failed one last year. Let's hope for a big one this year. And it's this rainfall that falls on these mountaintops that keeps them moist. And these animals that are getting sick and tired of moving, every time there's an ice age, it gets cold and dry, so they go up the mountains because it's moist there. A lot of them have just stayed there over deep time. So we've all of our unique plants and animals, or the vast majority of them, live on our mountaintops. And that's why when you go to the Dane Tree, it's where's Wally? Where's the animals? It's hard to see them.
A very quick announcement to make that I'm so excited. Our home education virtual portal is up and running, and you can visit that at www.australianwildlifeeducation.com. And if you are a parent or you know other parents who have children ages 4 to 12, this one is specifically for them, and they get to learn more about Australian wildlife.
Not only because we get there at the wrong time of day, but because a lot of them are nocturnal or up those mountaintops. So it's an odd rainforest for that. You go to any other lowland rainforest on Earth and you'll see plenty of animals in the lowland.
Yeah. The thing about wildlife too is a lot of us are just relying on our eyes all the time. We're not using our other senses to really experience nature and, you know, being able to listen and breathe it in and really feel it. We just always rely on our eyes of, you know, what we want to see. But really experiencing nature, I feel, is a whole bunch of things. It's not.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's why we love rainforest, Jody. I think it's the smells, it's the sounds,
yep,
the dawn of dusk, the changing of light to dark or dark to light. It's a special trigger for animals, and sounds are amazing. Experts, ecologists who go out there and survey for a living, they don't actually, when they fill out their sheets, they're not filling out I've seen it, they're filling out I've heard it. They're qualified enough to know what it sounds like. And anyone can do it. Anyone listening can start today, go on, get an app off your Google Store or whatever it is, and download a bird app, because they come with pictures and sound.
Yep.
You can slowly but surely teach yourself the sound of birds. I'm sure most people would know a kookaburra. I think, I'm hoping 90% of Australians could tell you with a blindfold on that that's a kookaburra. Well, you know, if you extrapolate that out to all of Australia's birds, with all having unique sounds, there are people out there that can actually identify those sounds. And you can too. Just practice. Yeah. Particularly if you're only going to do it in your own backyard or your own favourite national park. Or just stay in the wet tropics. But, you know, the sounds of birds in the mountaintops are very different to the sounds of birds on the coast too. So there's different suites of animals living in different locations.
I love how the sound can tell you a story. And, you know, it's like all of a sudden you're hearing, actually I heard a bird the other day and I was like, oh, the sound of summer. You know, I only hear them around this particular area during this month, but then you might hear certain calls and you're like, yep, that's breeding season, or, you know,
absolutely,
it's telling you the story of it. So it's not just about seeing, it's hearing, it's learning all that, and the story is created just from sound. So
thank you for reminding me. Yesterday afternoon, I heard my first buff-breasted paradise kingfisher. Some people might know them as white-tailed kingfishers, but they're a little tiny kingfisher that flow all the way from Papua New Guinea down here. I've always said the 7th of November. I noticed that one arrived on the 5th. So I'm going to write that in my diary. The first one in my backyard this year was the 5th of November. And they breed in the gully out the front of the house. So those babies make that trip on their own in the second week of March. Usually you might have some stragglers till the last week of March. But I set my calendar by those birds. And for those who are listening to us in the wet tropics, you know those, or even further south, those white pigeons that you see, those pied imperial pigeons, they are also a great way to set the calendar. Again, arriving in August, first or second week of August, and leaving in around March or even later. There's some now that stay around Cairns. So gentlemen in Cairns who's just counting them. Because we plant so many different plants in our cities, those birds have come down from New Guinea to feast on our rainforest. But if we've got plants that fruit all year round, you know what? They're lazy. They're not going to fly a couple of thousand kilometres home. Let's just stay and eat the garden fruit that we find in Cairns. And it's not apples and oranges, people. It's rainforest fruit. But there's also palms. They love their palm seeds as well. So if you drive around Cairns, there's so many different types of plants from all over the world planted that produce food for these birds all year round now. So they've decided to stay. Some of them have. Certainly the vast majority go back home. But I've drifted. So I really want to just let everybody know that at the Wet Tropics World Heritage Area is about 900,000 hectares in size. It's a pretty big block of land. It is literally west of Townsville to just south of Cooktown in length. So it's about 450 kilometres long. It's long and thin and narrow. It has the most vertebrate animals, and reminding everyone, vertebrates, amphibians, that's frogs, reptiles and snakes, birds and mammals, has the most number of those types of animals than anywhere else in Australia. And it has 4,000 plant species. That's far greater than anywhere else in Australia. And if you do all that maths and you have a look at all those living things that live in that space and you measure the scale of that 900,000 hectares against the scale of Australia, the land size of the wet tropics is only 0.26% of the Australian land mass. So I'll say that again, only 0.26%, but 32% of Australia's biodiversity occurs in that tiny little location. And that itself is one of the reasons why it's a World Heritage Area. That's what we call a natural phenomenon. How do we get 33% of all the living things in Australia jammed into 0.26% of its land mass? That's a natural phenomenon. That's a reason it's a World Heritage Area. There's other ways of thinking about World Heritage Areas that I'll just sidetrack. World Heritage Areas are significant for everybody. They're globally significant. They're significant to me personally. They're significant to Queenslanders. They're significant to Australians, but they're significant to the world. Therefore, one of a kind. And that's another way of thinking about it. They're irreplaceable. I don't know about you, but I've lost some irreplaceable things in my life. And it's a horrible feeling when you lose something you can't replace. Maybe it was given to you by a grandmother or grandfather or a special person in your life and you lose it. It's a horrible feeling. That's a great way to think about the tropics, World Heritage Area, or any World Heritage Area. They're one of a kind. They're irreplaceable. The other way to think about them is their iconic landscapes. If you think about Queensland's World Heritage Areas, the Great Barrier Reef, they're iconic. The Wet Tropics World Heritage Area is iconic. Fraser Island is a World Heritage Area. It's iconic. The Gongguanan Rainforest that I mentioned before, going from southeast Queensland to Newcastle. You might know you're in a World Heritage Area, but the amount of visitors that spend time in those rainforests know they're special, they're iconic landscapes. And here's a really interesting one that's not as common, as they're not as iconic because people don't know about it, but it is really special. 800 kilometres southwest of me here, or you as well, is Riversleigh World Heritage Area, which is in the Gulf Country. And what it shows us is what it was like in Australia 30 million years ago when Australia was, drum roll here, a continental-wide rainforest, or mostly a continent full of rainforest. Now, that's a really big statement, so let me just support this. How do we know Australia was a continental-wide rainforest? Because the rocks give us the answers, the clues, the fossils of Australia are well-studied. We know that near Geelong, which is just south of Melbourne, there's a fossil site there where the closest living examples of those fossils are in the wet tropics. So south of Melbourne was once quite a tropical forest, possibly a subtropical rainforest. Because 50 million years ago, the whole global climate was warm and wet. There's another amazing World Heritage Area in Frankfurt, Germany, that shows us what lived and died around a lake 50 million years ago. The earliest fossil monkey comes from there. The earliest fossil horses come from there. Whales with legs come from there. Early birds, phenomenal amounts of bird life. It really paints a picture. It's a snapshot in time. In those rocks is a snapshot in time 50 million years ago where Frankfurt, Germany was a rainforest. Today, it snows there for 4 months. It's a different time and place. So Riversleigh, back to Riversleigh in the Gulf Country on the Savannah Way, or just off the Savannah Way. It's a bit of a hot spot for those grey nomads who are doing the Savannah Way, or anyone doing the Savannah Way. And it's more and more popular to go from Broome to Cairns these days, either way. It's a fantastic. But they're locked in the rocks. Animals the size, marsupials the size of orangutans that lived in trees. We have small sheep-sized animals that lived in our rainforest. We have marsupial moles that lived in rainforest. Today, there's two types of marsupial mole in Australia, but they occur in our deserts. They used to live in our rainforest. We can see the evolution of songbirds. These are a really special part of the Australian landscape today. I've got some sad news for people. We Australia cannot claim to be the origin of marsupials or the origin of eucalypts. That's another story we'll tell you in a minute. But what we can claim is we are the origin of a group of birds called songbirds. They have a special thing in their throat called sparynx, singing. And these guys evolved and originated in Australia and then moved to the rest of the world, where they now dominate 60% of the world's bird life. It's dominated by songbirds, and their place of origin was Australia. So, sorry, Aussies, we'd love to win at everything, but at the moment we can't claim eucalypts as ours. They come from South America. Marsupials came from North America, and I think I'll probably just venture off there on that story and talk about our connections to other continents, our time in isolation, and our time when we collided with Southeast Asia. Have you ever thought, look outside the window, where does all those plants and animals come from? Where did this incredible country of Australia get its plants and animals from? It's a really good question. I think a lot of us think they all just originated in Australia, but it's more complex than that. A theory called continental drift is supported by another theory called plate tectonics, and it's globally accepted as how continents move around the Earth. So continents have not always been where they are. Australia has not always been pushed up against Southeast Asia with a big gap between us and Antarctica and not connected to South America. That's not been the case. We have been connected to the world's continents. 200 million years ago, Australia was, like most of the continents on Earth, attached together in a giant jigsaw puzzle that was about to be pulled apart. 150 million years ago, Australia moved away from the northern continents of the world, and everyone's familiar with the word Gondwana, and that is called Gondwana, and Gondwana was made up of Africa, South America, Australia, Antarctica, Saudi Arabia, New Zealand, and of course Australia. And slowly but surely, those continents started to separate. But we are a triplet. Famously, Australia has been connected to Antarctica and South America for a very long period of time. So when we look at the fossils of Antarctica and we look at the living animals and fossils of South America, we can see those connections. And eucalypts, for example, the oldest known fossil eucalypt, which is undeniably a eucalypt, and the American paleobotanist who discovered this really loved to tease Australians about this, because we lost the eucalypts as being the place of origin now in South America. And it's just clearly globally accepted by scientists that eucalypts evolved in Australia, moved through Antarctica onto the Australian continent just as Australia broke away from Antarctica. But on that life raft called Australia, as it broke away from Antarctica, the marsupials came down through North America, and that's where they originated. And they're still there. There's still one marsupial species in North America. They passed through South America. There's about 70 different types of living marsupial today. They made their way across Antarctica and jumped onto the island raft of Australia at the right amount of time, because it left Antarctica 50 million years ago. So now there's a bit of an understanding of our connections to other continents and how Australia obtained marsupials and eucalypts. Now we're going to be in isolation. So we break away from Antarctica. We've got all the room in the world in front of us there to move north, which we do as a continent. On board that island, continental raft, the ancestral eucalypts, the ancestral marsupials, they start to evolve in magnificent, splendid isolation. No competition from other things entering. It's just them doing their own thing with everything else that was on that continent as it moved away. As it moved north, the world started to cool down to one of our big, giant global ice ages. But Australia's moving north, and just keeping enough pace moving north to keep away from that freezing. So things are evolving in isolation. They're enjoying splendid isolation where they can do their own thing. Now we have hundreds of species of marsupials that are unique to Australia. Now we have 700 to 800 types of eucalypt that are just loving this isolation and using every ability they have to dominate these new habitats, because we're drying out, the rainforest receding, continental-wide rainforest. It's got to find somewhere to live. So where does it end up? Remember, it ends up on that east coast where that rainfall is trapped by those mountains, the Great Dividing Range. It's found a refuge. It's found a space and a place to grow. And it represents what was out there from here to the west coast of WA. That was a giant rainforest. So it's an incredible thing. So we've got connections to other continents. We've got splendid isolation where we breed our own uniquely Australian things. That was the chance for songbirds to evolve too. They were evolving in those shrinking rainforests, and they were moving towards the coast. They were following the rainforest in the mountains of the east coast of Australia, and that's where they are today. And then we hit Southeast Asia. We bumped into Indonesia, which we call Indonesia today. And I just want to remind everybody that I'm always making sure that New Guinea's included in this. When I say Australia, I mean New Guinea as well. We're always a part of New Guinea. We talked about rising and falling oceans because of ice ages trapping floating ice on the poles, water levels, sea levels drop. But when that ice defrosts, sea levels rise. So you could walk to New Guinea not that long ago. You could walk to Tasmania not that long ago. Our traditional owners did. And that Bass Strait filled in just in time for the thylacine to be isolated from the dingo. The dingo never made it to Australia. The Tasmanian tiger could live there in peace and harmony because on the mainland, thylacines were very common. We've got their fully mummified skeletons. We've got rock art all over Australia of thylacines on the mainland. We know Tasmanian tigers lived on the mainland not that long ago. But they only ended up in Tasmania because the dingo was kept out. And then, of course, tragically and sadly, in the 1930s, the last one was shot there. That's another story for another day. Let's go back to...
Lots of people still looking for them, Terry.
Yeah, I'm still very hopeful. Look, I've spent so much time in Tassie, unfortunately. Oh, it'd be a miracle. We're all wounded. All of us that have been in this business for a long time, there's not too many weeks that go by that I don't think of what a sad and tragic loss that is for us. As a people, as a nation of people, to lose a really special animal. We have a whole bunch of animals all over the world that are really special, that belong to very small families, that are uniquely featured, that are not kind of closely related to a whole bunch of other things. And the thylacine was one of those. We lost one of our most significant animals a long time ago. So we're still wounded from that. We'll move on. So we bump into Southeast Asia. What happens? Well, famously, no land bridges. So if you think of Indonesia, for those who don't know, there's a thing called the Wallace Line in between us and Indonesia. And on the west of the Wallace Line, you have primates and apes and rhinos and tapirs and elephants and tigers and leopards. To the east of that line, you've got cockatoos and cuscus and kangaroos and echidnas and cassowaries. But there's no mixing of those faunas. The elephants and the rhinos and the tapirs and the apes and the hornbills are all on their own over there. They didn't get across into Australasia because there's really deep ocean trenches through that part of the world. There's also really fast-moving currents through that part of the world. However, things did get across. Small mobile things got across. Plants got across in the tummies of birds and bats. And those Southeast Asian plants started to evade Australasia about 15 million years ago, probably started. The most expert advice, and this is one of the most studied topics at the moment, is the Australian Tropical Herbarium is spending an enormous amount of energy studying this. It's fascinating stuff for people like me, how these Southeast Asian plants invaded Australia and slowly made their way through the island archipelago of Indonesia, through New Guinea, into Australia. So some of our lowland rainforests of the wet tropics, a good 46, 47% of those plants in our lowlands are from Southeast Asia. They're clearly related to Southeast Asian plants. Some of them are exactly the same species. So it's really interesting to know that looking out your window, defining what you're looking at, it has three origins. It could be originated from our connections to other continents, particularly South America and Antarctica, but New Caledonia, New Zealand, Madagascar, South Africa, we still have connections with them too in the landscape today. And then in splendid isolation, evolving those things that we see as really Australian things like eucalypts, marsupials and wattles, they had all that time in the world to become, and songbirds, their own special thing. And then bumping into Southeast Asia, interesting. We got bats, we got rats, and we got lizards and snakes. So our incredible endemic Boyd's forest dragon, which is a beautiful rainforest lizard from the wet tropics, is really only found in the wet tropics. It has a friend down in the Gondwanan rainforest called the southern angle-headed dragon, and their group is really dominant in Southeast Asia. So clearly the ancestor of the Boyd's forest dragon and the southern angle-headed dragon came in from Southeast Asia. And we theorise that these small animals, who could not have to eat for weeks on end, like for those who didn't know, snakes and reptiles, lizards can go a couple of weeks without feeding and sometimes drinking too. They probably found their way down the island archipelagos of Indonesia on flood debris. You know, some of the wettest landscapes in the world in Southeast Asia, big rivers churning out huge rainforest logs. I've been down the South Johnson, which is in Innisfail, guys, for the main street of Innisfail, literally walk down to the Johnson River, get there after a big, 1,000-millimetre rain event over a week, And you can see the same thing. You can see giant rainforest trees floating down the river as faster than you can walk. And those trees are going to move out to sea, and anything on them won't survive because there's nowhere to go. But over deep time, those lizards and snakes made their way down into Australia.
I really hope you're enjoying the chat so far with Terry Carmichael. Now, we have got the second part of the episode out next week, so make sure you stay tuned for that. But otherwise, if you want to know some more information in the meantime, you can head to our podcast notes and you can find the Wet Tropics Management Authority website. You can see what it is that Terry is talking about. But otherwise, stay tuned for part two next week.